In the years after the Great War, as it was called at the time, and continuing through World War II, the United States maintained two agencies for decoding intercepted communications, one in the Army and one in the Navy. This arrangement may have had the merit of making the maximum number of bureaucrats happy, but it sometimes led to counterproductive results. For instance, in September 1940, after the Army's codebreakers solved Japan's most secure diplomatic code, known to the Americans as Purple, the question arose as to how to do the voluminous work of actually reading each day's messages. Each service felt an imperative to keep not only the Empire of Japan, but also the other service, in its place. After protracted negotiations, the two sides agreed that the Navy's outfit, OP-20G, would handle the messages received on odd-numbered days, while the Army's Signal Intelligence Service would handle those received on even-numbered days. The fruits of their labors would be given to the President by his Army aide in odd-numbered months, by his Naval aide in even-numbered months. The scheme was internally logical, but ludicrous. In another instance, when the rivalry showed itself, after the war with Hitler was underway, a British representative to the US code-breaking units found himself forbidden by the US Army from sharing details of their conversations with the US Navy. The British had endured similar rivalries between their own services during World War I. Unlike the American government, however, the British sought to avert such issues in the future by fusing their Army and Navy code-breaking services into a single unit following the end of the war. In October 1919, 11 months after the armistice, Prime Minister David Lloyd George's War Cabinet ordered the creation of a new organization, the Government Code and Cipher School, to be located in the Watergate House in central London. Its publicly revealed mission was defensive, to advise as to the security of codes and ciphers used by all government departments and to help in setting them up. Code breaking was to be an additional, highly secret one. The Admiralty had acceded to the change on one condition, that the head of the new organization would be one of its own, namely Alexander G. Denniston, known as Alistair, or simply AGD. His education at Bonn University, and the German fluency that had come with it, led to his being one of the first four staff recruited to Room 40, the Admiralty's small code-breaking office, in 1914. The extent of his continental education, he had also studied at the Sorbonne in Paris, was unusual for a British naval officer of the time. He was an athletic Scotsman with bright blue eyes. As a younger man, he had played for Scotland's field hockey team in the 1908 Olympics. His stature, small and slight, resembled that of a jockey or a rower's coxswain. He was accustomed to going without. His father had died when he was 11, after which his mother struggled financially to raise him and his two younger siblings. Outwardly, his manner tended to be stiff and correct, concealing a humane interest in those with whom he worked, and a tolerance of eccentricity. The latter quality could prove invaluable. Cryptanalysts, one observer noted at the time, were somewhat kittle cattle to deal with, and all of them, if they are any good, have somewhat peculiar temperaments. Thus the Admiralty made its stand. "We should only consent to pool our staff with that of the War Office, Army, on condition that Commander A.G. Denniston is placed in charge of the new department," the head of Naval Intelligence declared. He added, "Denniston is not only the best man we have had, but he is the only one we have left with special genius for this work. We shall not be able to retain him in a subordinate capacity, and no advantage of concentration or cooperation with the War Office would compensate us for the loss of his services." But in the end, what seems to have been decisive in Denniston's selection, in addition to the Admiralty's support, was his attitude. The War Office's pick, a Major Malcolm Hay, was asked whether he was willing to be second in command under Denniston. Hay gave a flat no. Denniston, asked whether he would work under Hay, said yes without hesitation. He would serve wherever he was needed. Denniston received the nod. Denniston had never run anything before. The wartime head of Room 40 had retired in January. He disliked anything to do with bureaucracy and administration. Inevitably, some of his peers were skeptical of his elevation, one of them carping that he was possibly fit to manage a small sweet shop in the East End. He would prove them wrong, although not wrong enough.